Want to try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
One bite will destroy your body.
Stop it! Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com. Cygnos.com with code SPARK. Cygnos.
He was a preacher who couldn't resist temptation.
The priest is accused of killing Sister Margaret Ann Paul in the chapel.
The strongest of cases against a powerful preacher in a town of true believers.
You're listening to Seven Deadly Sinners.
The legal age for marriage is at puberty. I'm not married to any teenage girls who don't want to be. I'm 74 years old.
I don't remember reading that in the Bible, sir.
You don't know anything about the Bible.
And he kept stabbing and smiling.
410 wounds, scars upon scars.
Welcome back to season 2 of Seven Deadly Sinners. This season is going to be dark. Dark, dark. But hey, what isn't dark about 2020? I want to thank you all so much for listening and for interacting with us on Instagram. If you're not already following us, we're on Instagram at Seven Deadly Sinners Podcast. And hey, tag us in your Insta story. Let us know where you're listening. We love hearing from you. Okay, now let's dive into this horrific crime in the heart of the Bible Belt. Lust, in the simplest of terms, can be described as an intense longing, perhaps a coming-of-age, confused, constant thought about a high school crush or a celebrity you see on TV. Teenage girls and teenage boys may lust after a poster of the Hemsworth brothers or Rachel McAdams. People who are in the throes of lust may lose their sensibilities, since lust seems unable to recognize the reality of a situation, or motivates one to neglect it. This seems to give the lustful person a pass of sorts. You were caught up by your hormones, or you drank too much and didn't think it through. It's an excuse that can be slightly valid in the most innocent of cases, but there's a fine line between a crush and lust crossing dangerously over into stalking, non-consent, or even worse, violent sexual assault. But the crush excuse or innocent lack of sensibility in the moment does not describe the subject of this season's lustful lecher, Pastor Matt Baker. No, in fact, he was callous, unashamed, and unapologetic in his pursuit to control and take what he felt he deserved. He ordained, no pun intended, the time or place of the encounter. He sought to conquest and manipulate, but mostly barrel his way into groping or finding the most disgusting of times to violate innocent teens, women, and overall, everyone that knew him. But the person he manipulated most, gaslit and violated, was his unbelievably devoted wife, whose life was destroyed by her husband, Matt Baker. And more gut-wrenching is that she was always the first one in the ring, fighting for his honor. Teddy Roosevelt gave a speech in 1910 that Brené Brown, coolest lady ever in my opinion, expanded on in her book, Daring Greatly. It said, "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at best knows in the end, the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly." Carrie was the type of person to not give up on her life and not give up on those around her, even after suffering the most insufferable tragedy. No, she pushed on. She was always striving to be better in her relationship to Matt, one in which she had built much of her identity on. And she was always focused on being the best mother possible to her little girls. Carrie Baker was pushing on daily, enduring a mother's biggest heartbreak, but she was finding healthy ways to cope and ways to help others. She was in the arena, her face marred by dust and sweat and blood. She wasn't perfect, but she was willing to fight and fight again for the ones she loved. She knew there was no effort without a failure here and there. But she was always enthusiastic in her fight, and she did this all with some bangles on her wrist, flip-flops on her feet, and a spirit she would not let be broken. Matt Baker, on the other hand, is an unimpressive blob in my opinion. I'd like to point out that I have zero psychology background and I am not a licensed professional, but I have done a ton of research and have dated a lot of assholes, so I'm going to level with you. Much of Matt's upbringing, I believe, defines his adult, and I use that term loosely, behavior. He was coddled by his mother. She made excuses for him and viewed him as above repercussions. This, I believe, gave Matt Baker Little Prince Syndrome, which I will describe in depth in a few moments. Matt Baker proves that when you combine lust with a malignant narcissist, it can produce deadly results. But could he get away with his deplorable behavior forever? Not on Carrie's mom, Linda, or her aunt's watch. Charlie's Angels, as they went on to call themselves, would be the catalyst to investigate Matt Baker's deceptions and lies, working to expose him as a narcissistic bully and a lifelong sexual predator.
Don't mess with our family. Don't mess with us. We will fight for the truth.
He was a preacher who couldn't resist temptation.
A former pastor in Kerrville behind bars tonight, accused of murdering his wife more than a year ago.
I made a mistake here because a manipulative liar wearing the mask of God came into my life.
On August 13th, 1974, bubbly blonde Carrie Lynn Baker was born in Salt Lake City to her mother Linda and her father Scott. Linda, an intelligent woman with a short haircut and brave, steadfast presence. A bravery that is likely due to a string of tragedies that would plague her life. For not long after Carrie's birth, Linda and Carrie would leave the mountains of Salt Lake City and move in with Linda's sister Kay in Waco, Texas, after Linda was dealt a heartbreaking blow. Linda's first husband, Scott, a fellow student at the University of Utah, was tragically killed in a motorcycle accident. Carrie was so small that she didn't even remember her father, but Linda had lost her love and she was alone with a tiny baby. Being the fighter that Linda is, though, she picked up the pieces of her life and moved down to Waco and enrolled in Baylor University, where her younger sister Kay was a student. They moved in with Kay and Carrie was cared for by her doting mom and her second mom, Aunt Kay. Aunt Kay says that they are a family of She-Ras, a close-knit family who would do anything for each other. Linda, the ever so pragmatic woman that she is, knew when to ask for help and to not hold in pain that ultimately manifests in the wrong ways. She did the right thing and sought counseling after Scott died. And then Linda began to move on. She was studying hard and caring for little Carrie. And then it was yet another disaster that would bring a young man into her life, Jim Doolin, who would become her lifelong partner and father to Carrie and her brother Adam. December 1977, a fire broke out in Linda and Kay's apartment, and they lost nearly everything. After the fire burnt out and they were left to gather the last bit of their belongings, Jim, a tall man with glasses, a friend of their neighbor's, offered his truck to transport the little they had left to their new home. And before long, they were dating. Jim was a member of the National Guard, and he worked for the Department of Defense. He was a wonderful man through and through, a stark contrast to the man Matt's dad, Oscar Baker, whose foster children would describe as abusive during a trial we will hear about later. All was well with their new little family, and Jim had adopted Carrie, whom he absolutely adored, and Carrie was blossoming into an adorable force to be reckoned with. Linda was a busy mom who taught high school and continued her education working on a master's degree. Carrie did well in school too. She played sports and was a cheerleader. She was a bright, funny girl and was described by her friends as fearless and full of joy and laughter. She was beautiful with a heart-shaped face, blonde hair, and big blue eyes. You always noticed Carrie. She was even named Heart of Texas Sweetheart at a ceremony at the fairgrounds. They were a family grounded in faith. Carrie took her religion seriously, and she knew she wanted a family of her own, held together by her faith. They were such a close family. They were always with Linda's sisters and their kids, and Carrie was particularly close with her Aunt Nancy's daughter, Lindsay, a cute brown-haired girl 5 years younger than Carrie. But the two were inseparable. Lindsay and Carrie were more like sisters than cousins. The Doolins' life was moving along, filled with love and a new job success for Linda. She had finished her master's and was working on her doctorate and got a job teaching communications at Waco's McLennan Community College, a specific type of communications that I thought about constantly as this case evolved. Linda Doolin is a professor of business and organizational communication and would teach her students things like, quote, "One should never give advice, but rather ask others why they thought the way they did and what they believed they should do about it." Something Linda would later come to regret not using with her own daughter. When she graduated high school, Carrie enrolled in Texas Tech University in 1993, intending to major in family studies. She joined a sorority and enjoyed parties here and there. But after her first year at Texas Tech, she felt she was headed in the wrong direction and wanted to get her life back on track. And she told her mom that she wanted to move back to Waco and focus more. She wanted to work with kids and be a teacher. And she figured that if she was at the conservative Baylor University, she was setting herself up to meet a good Christian man. If there was any place she was going to find a husband, it was Baylor Ring by Spring University, a motto at the forefront of many students' minds. Carrie was headstrong and confident and marched to the beat of her own drum. But she seemed hard on herself. Her partying was likely nothing compared to what most college kids do, and her focus to find a good Christian man whom she could admire does show that she maybe viewed herself as imperfect in the eyes of God. This could have been caused by her getting pregnant at 18 with her high school boyfriend and suffering a miscarriage. She perhaps felt guilt or shame for having sex before marriage, coupled with the heartbreak of losing a baby. And this may have defined the way she would later blame herself in her future marriage. Committed to finding a man that would put faith and family first, like the household she grew up in, her plan quickly came to fruition when she began working at Waco's First Baptist Church, a church she attended as a toddler. As a lifeguard at the youth pool, she met a personable and unassuming young man with a boyish face, Matt Baker. And she thought she had met her pious Prince Charming. But little did she know, he was a prince more in his entitlement to whatever he desired than he was the prince of a man she believed. And their courtship accelerated quicker than a Baptist woman bakes a casserole in your time of need. But who was this perfect Christian Casanova? Matthew D. Baker was born on September 7, 1971, to staunch Baptist parents, Barbara and Oscar Baker. Barbara, a short, stocky woman with a thick head of gray hair that envelops her forehead. She has been described as non-emotional, a trait she may have passed down to her son. Oscar, his father, came from a farming background, and I honestly can't find one photo of the man, but both he and Barbara will be important later in this story. When Matt was 1 year old, his family moved into a large two-story home where Barbara and Oscar became house parents of a group home, part of a Dallas-based chain of foster homes and orphanages, the Buckner Baptist Benevolences. From 1974 to 1981, they oversaw the care of up to 10 children at a time. Barbara Baker idealized this time, saying, 10 was the perfect number of children to look after. Children, we will later find out, were more in danger oftentimes than looked after. The home was co-ed and children shuffled in and out. When one child left, another came to live. Some of the children suffered handicaps, some troubled, and some just didn't have parents that could take care of them. Matt claims that growing up in this household taught him Christian love, as he got to experience growing up with children of all races and backgrounds. Like being a foster mom of 10 at a time, Barbara recalls her son Matt's childhood with rose-colored glasses. She remembers him as near perfect and a mature child that even at 6 years old, he was able to counsel the troubled foster children living in their home. Barb. Listen, Matt wasn't even mature enough as an adult to counsel himself or at the very least seek counseling for his sexual addiction and predatory urges. She also says that she can't think of one time that she ever had to discipline him. Well, that makes so much sense now, because in researching this case, I couldn't put my finger on a term or category to define Matt Baker. But I finally happened upon something called Little Prince Syndrome. Remember this list as I describe his behavior throughout, because he checks every box multiple times in his life. Matt Baker's Little Prince Syndrome meant that he never had to develop into an emotionally mature adult because he was so coddled along the way by his mother and then eventually Carrie. In an article in Psychology Today by Berit Brogard, PhD, she breaks down the characteristics of Little Prince Syndrome. She states that while it is not considered an official mental disorder, it is a common condition, one which often results from an overly protective mother, a helicopter mom, or a parent who gives their son or daughter free range and too much praise and attention during childhood and adolescence. Such parental behavior is also sometimes referred to as emotional incest. The term emotional incest is also used to describe cases in which parents treat their child as their partner or spouse. This can be asking a child for advice on adult issues, having them play therapist for you, or making your child your best friend and only source of self-esteem. Little princes and princesses, she defines them as, are grown men or women who act as if they are selfish children, narcissistic teenagers, or irresponsible young adults, and feel entitled to behave as they see fit. Following are 10 traits typical of someone living with Little Prince or Princess Syndrome. But to simplify for Matt Baker, we will be referring to Little Prince only. Number 1. He is in touch with his mom almost every day. She is more in his life than anyone else. She checks up on him and worries about him, even though he's a grown man. She might buy his clothes and his groceries and do his laundry for him. Number 2. He acts like a child, a teenager, or a person who is much younger than he is. Number 3. He acts as if women should serve him. He expects to be taken care of and pampered on demand. He will happily take, but never give. 4. He cannot maintain a long-term, stable romantic relationship. Former partners end up becoming his enemies or new playmates. 5. He is commitment-phobic in nearly all areas of life. Despite having a needy attachment style, it can take him 6 months to commit to buying a new sofa. 6. He has few, if any, close friends. His friends consist mostly of his mom and the strangers he meets when out playing or whatever. 7. He is often passive-aggressive, meaning he has the tendency to engage in an indirect expression of hostility through acts such as subtle insults, sullen behavior, stubbornness, or a deliberate failure to accomplish required tasks. 8. He is a narcissist, or exhibits a childish selfishness. If something is even mildly inconvenient, he will resist doing it. 9. He is financially irresponsible. He spends too much money playing, chasing women. 10. He rarely thinks anything is his fault. He blames everyone around him for everything that goes wrong in his life, even his mother if he can't find another scapegoat. Again, we will come back to these many times in Matt Baker's wasted life. In high school, Matt was scrawny and worked as a student trainer with the basketball team. He played tuba in the band, had a few girlfriends here and there, but former classmates would remember that he wasn't the type to go gaga over girls. Well, perhaps this was before the dawn of the internet and you couldn't look at his search history. Anywho, No one from his childhood was surprised that Matt Baker would go on to become a pastor. And off he went, graduating high school in the spring of 1990 with a partial scholarship at Baylor, where he planned to major in church recreation and athletic training, a position and major he would later use to corner and sexually assault fellow students. This first reported incident would occur not long after he entered Baylor, where he was working as a trainer with the school's football team. Listen, I don't claim to be up on my athletic trainer criteria, but don't you kind of have to have like a prior athletic, experience yourself to get the full spectrum of the job? Okay, sorry, that was more about my personal hatred of him than anything. Matt was able to fly under the radar for a while, besides the rumors here and there of him trying to kiss girls at parties. But it wasn't until mid-December 1991 that Matt would go on to inflict such emotional duress on a young co-ed that she eventually had to leave school. Laura Wilson was a freshman with short blonde hair majoring in pre-med. She was working in the athletic training program, and it wasn't uncommon for the freshman students in that program to be hazed like they were in a fraternity or sorority. They were told to clean toilets and baseboards with toothbrushes, astroturf with a broom. One afternoon, during finals week, she ended up at the stadium alone, when normally she should have been with someone, but she was sent there to do the horrible job of cleaning toilets. As she was walking outside the stadium to the old training room, she encountered Matt, who offered to help her. She was surprised because anyone above the freshman didn't ever offer to help. Well, as they walked to the old training room, Matt began acting like a moron, and he started poking her from behind with a broom. An attribute of Little Prince syndrome, which is he acts like a child, a teenager, or a person much younger than he is. But in moments, his actions would not be so childlike. She asked him to stop, but he kept poking her. She was getting very annoyed. So to get away from him, she told Matt she was going to clean the bathroom, and he said he'd work on the rest. But moments later, while she was bending over cleaning a stall, Matt appeared directly behind her. And what happened next was horrifying. She remembers that Matt moved quick. He pinned her arms behind her, forcing himself against her as he kept trying to kiss her. She was terrified. She kept saying that she had a boyfriend and kept telling him to stop, but he wouldn't. Her heart was pounding, and he persisted, and he picked her up in a bear hug and set her down on a sink, and then forced her legs open and stood between them, pushing against her as he tried to kiss her. But then, brave Laura bit into his shoulder, and he was so startled that he let go long enough for her to jump off the sink and run. But Matt caught up to her, coming at her from behind, wrestling over to a bench where he pulled her on top of him, again pushing her thighs apart. And he was able to hold her arms behind her with one of his arms, and he began fondling her with the other. She screamed and fought as minutes passed, and then, all of a sudden, he looked at her and just said, "I'm done." His smug ass literally waltzed away, satisfied with whatever pleasure he had garnered from the terrifying and life-changing experience Laura endured. This makes sense, as it fits into one of the characteristics of Little Prince syndrome. Quote, "He acts as if women should serve him. He expects to be taken care of and pampered on demand. He will happily take but never give." This is also the expectation that Carrie Baker must have felt while adamantly defending her husband throughout their whole marriage. She is there to serve and obey. This incident also showed telltale signs of a sexual predator. In another article from Psychology Today, titled "The Thinking Process of Sexual Predators, With Enhanced Power, the Predator Reveals Himself," written by Stanton E. Samenow, PhD. He says, "In the perpetrator's approach to potential sexual targets, he regards himself as irresistible and seeks to have this affirmed. He is certain that any person whom he finds desirable will be attracted to him. A friendly smile may confirm that he is desired and that he can proceed with his conquest. This thinking occurs even with complete strangers, whom he quickly regards as his property. The idea is to conquer a body, not have a relationship. Achieving his objective provides him with a buildup. He has sex on his mind a great deal of the time, looking at females as potential targets. He is fueled by the pursuit of power and control. A critical part of the perpetrator's self-image is being able to dominate others. And when it comes to right and wrong, he makes his own rules. Personally, what struck me was the subtitle in this. With enhanced power, the predator reveals himself. In Laura's case, he was a grade above her and had seniority in the program. When he becomes pastor, he thinks, no one questions the actions of a godly man. And in his marriage to Carrie, he preyed on her desire to be the perfect wife and have the perfect family, and she was dutifully willing to believe everything Matt Baker said because he was her husband and he was going to be a minister. I mean, he was a future Baptist minister in a city known as Jerusalem on the Brazos. I mean, what more credibility of his character do you people need?
She was marrying a Baptist minister. How good is that?
After the incident, the terrified Laura called her mom immediately from a payphone. She was shaking and crying. Her mother told her she was on her way to the campus to be with her daughter, and that her daughter needed to contact Coach Mike Sims immediately. As Laura was trying to get out of the area where her assault had occurred, she took a wrong turn to find that the doors were locked and was forced to walk outside the stadium to an open gate, where she ran into one of the other coaches. He asked her what was wrong. She broke down and told him everything, to which he replied, "Find Mike Sims and tell him. We won't stand for this behavior." Laura must have felt some relief knowing that she was being protected by the school, but that feeling wouldn't last. Her and her mom met with Mike Sims, who told them that he had called Matt into his office and Matt had admitted to what happened, but he said he didn't realize he was hurting her. Laura said this wasn't true. She had attempted to fight him off, even biting him in the shoulder. Sims heard her out and said that this would be handled by the university and told her not to involve the police. Laura and her mom agreed, only to find out that handle it was the exact opposite of what they did. Laura lay awake all night crying and reliving the attack, only to find out the attack on her character had just begun. Upon returning to the practices just one time, Laura realized that students were whispering and laughing about her. Matt had already spun a story to everyone, saying how silly she was to get upset for him just poking her with a broom. This blaming of others was Matt's go-to move, another symptom of Little Prince syndrome. The Little Prince rarely thinks anything is his fault. He blames everyone around him for everything that goes wrong in his life. In the end, Laura felt she had lost. Matt, on the other hand, was only rewarded. His only punishment was to be confined to the training room to work with the players. Laura said, "That was something that only the seniors were able to do. It wasn't a punishment. It was more of a promotion." Laura eventually dropped out of athletic training, left Baylor and Waco, Texas, and suffered years of panics and nightmares. But Laura Wilson wouldn't be a victim forever, because she will come back to haunt Matt Baker years and years down the road when Laura gets her day in court. Over the years, the story he would tell his mother and others is that Laura's version of the events was wrong. What really happened is that she became hysterical for some unknown reason when the lights went out unexpectedly in the locker room. He would say that the school told him not to worry about it and that he had done nothing wrong. Who knows what happened with Mike Sims and the other inner workings of Baylor, because they declined to comment later, so no one would really know if Matt Baker was ever punished. But a police report was never filed, which allowed Matt Baker to continue his predatory behavior towards young girls and women. One of which was his high school girlfriend, Dina. They were all at a party with high school friends, and Matt began flirting with her, rekindling an old flame. She was still in high school, well, he was a sophomore in college. After the party, he followed her to her parents' house, where she says there was heavy petting, things were getting physical, but what happened moments later scared her. He began to act unlike he ever did in high school. He became super aggressive and he was relentless, so much so that she had to use all of her strength to push him off. She worries of what might have happened had her parents not showed back up at home and Matt was startled enough to get off of her. Embedding Little Prince syndrome more into Matt Baker's DNA, his mother Barbara said of the two young women's accounts of her son's actions, You know, the perfect son she never had to discipline. She scoffed at the woman's feelings and said, Matt was maybe getting a little too aggressive, but what teenage boy doesn't? Oh, Barbie, my friend, is this the same logic you used when your husband was later accused of serious criminal sexual behavior? So Matt went on his merry way, enjoying college, getting pretty good grades, and just 1 month after his attack on Laura Wilson, he was given an incredibly desirable and sought-after position as an intern in the recreation department at First Baptist Church of Waco, the premier church in the city with close ties to Baylor. Like many vultures who violate women and young girls, Matt set himself up to be immersed in a world where he had easy access to the vulnerable youth working and hanging at the rec center at the summer youth camp, and he sauntered into this job with a position of godly authority. It was here that he met the effervescent Carrie Lynn Baker while she was a lifeguard at First Baptist in the spring of 1994. Carrie's mom, Linda, would later say that Carrie was drawn to Matt because Carrie believed he was a good boy. Perhaps his round face and blue eyes almost made him seem like an innocent young man. He was a senior and she was a sophomore. Matt was on the shorter side at 5'7", and when Carrie wore heels, she was shoulder to shoulder to him. Carrie told friends that from the beginning, she knew Matt was the one. And one of Matt's classmates said, a lot of girls at Baylor thought he was a catch. And with the culture of Baylor University and the Baptist religion in general, many of the girls felt intense pressure to find the right man and settle down, hence the term ring by spring. We were Baptist girls looking for the right man to settle down with. And Matt talked a lot about faith. He sounded like a good boy, active in church, and that was very appealing. Matt said that he was drawn to Carrie because she was upbeat and happy, and she loved her family. Family came first. You could see that in her, he said. On their first date, they went and saw the Meg Ryan and Andy Garcia movie, When a Man Loves a Woman. Everything seemed perfect to Carrie. Their relationship moved so fast that both Matt and Carrie's parents were concerned that the pace was too quick. When Linda first met Matt, she recalls not being impressed. She said, he was just kind of okay. But Carrie was smitten, even though she couldn't understand why. Soon, her other relatives started to realize that Matt seemed a little bit off. While at family gatherings, the other men would watch sports and hang with the boys. But Matt would just hover around Carrie, listening in on her conversations with her other female aunts and cousins. He was always around. He always wanted to be with the women. It was just strange, they later would recall. At one family gathering, he caught Carrie's 14-year-old cousin alone. Her cousin was dressed in a shortish skirt, and Matt approached her and asked her if she was wearing any panties under her skirt. The cousin didn't ever tell anyone until much later, but she was among many of the women in Carrie's family who thought Matt was a creep. And even more out in the open, he would consistently make Carrie's other cousin, Lindsay, very uncomfortable. In another immature display by Matt, and I don't know how he got away with this, but almost every time he saw Lindsay, he would make a suggestive motion at her. Not touching her, but acting like he was going to squeeze her breasts, you know, like the honk honk type of thing. And when he hugged her, he was invasive, like he enjoyed it too much. No one ever told Carrie about their concerns, though, because they said she was in love and they didn't want to upset her. A month after they met, Matt brought Carrie home to meet his parents, who also thought they were moving too fast. Matt listened to his mother's concerns and he agreed to slow down. But then when it came time to find a living situation for the fall semester, he decided they should move in together, reasoning that two could live as cheaply as one. And Carrie was eager to marry Matt, so they moved in together. But despite what you might think, oh, you know, like living with someone, you keep tabs on them more, you get to know their secrets more. This wasn't the case for Carrie, because there was so much going on behind the scenes in Matt's life that Carrie, her parents, and likely his parents had no idea about. At his new job, he had begun propositioning teenage girls for sex. A young gymnast at his job said that Matt tried to corner her, saying that he wanted to have intercourse behind the bins that held the roller skates. Matt denied everything. But almost simultaneously, while he's creeping out almost every single teenage girl and woman he comes in contact with, Carrie was falling deeper in love, telling her parents she was ready to marry Matt after only 2 months of dating. She reasoned to her parents that Matt was a really good Christian, and we don't want to wait. Linda and Jim tried to put their foot down, so concerned that they even threatened to no longer pay her tuition. Carrie ignored their threats, though, and soon after they were engaged. The parents' hands were tied, so at that point, Barbara and Linda felt like they needed to become acquainted. They met up for lunch, and something bizarre happened. Out of nowhere, Barbara, no boundaries baker, leaned into Linda and said, "You know Matt's a virgin, right?" Linda was at a loss for words and just said, "Oh." When Linda told Carrie, Carrie agreed that it was a little weird, but Carrie, blinded by love, waved it away. Then came time for the wedding. Carrie told her mother that one of their family friends was going to be Matt's best man. Linda was confused and asked, "Why didn't he pick one of his best friends?" Carrie responded, "Matt doesn't really have many friends." This began Carrie's cycle of feeling bad for Matt, having pity on him so much so that when she got her teacher job and when all the other teachers would go out after school to hang and they would invite Carrie, she'd tell them that she couldn't go, that she had to get home to be with Matt. One teacher remembered that it appeared that Matt never let Carrie be alone. Quote, "The few times we did talk Carrie into going out with us, her phone rang constantly. It was if Matt needed something. They'd say he'd call 6 or 7 times, and he was always checking up on her." One of the fellow teachers told Carrie, "You know you are entitled to have friends." Carrie said, "I know, but I just feel so sorry for Matt." Regardless, Carrie married Matt Baker in 1994, when she was just 20 years old and he was 22. Unbeknownst to Carrie, about a week after they were married, Matt was called into the office again to discuss another allegation. A middle-aged female custodian had been approached by Matt. He said to her, "I know what it's like to be with a young woman, but I'd like to know what it's like to be with a mature woman." Matt denied all allegations once again. But one of his superiors wasn't as easy to let it go. He kept his eye on Matt, and he said to him, "I don't know what's going on here, but you need to get professional help because this is going to ruin your life." This would eventually get back to Carrie either by rumor or by Matt's watered-down recollection of the events. And this began Carrie's unrelenting defense of Matt. Carrie told her mom and dad about what had happened, and she was so furious by these women's allegations. How could they say that? Matt wouldn't do anything like that. She reasoned that maybe the two women are just jealous and they're angry they haven't found a nice man. Matt would insist to everyone that these women were just retaliating. He said that they had flirted with him and their claims are nothing more than revenge because he had rebuffed them. He says he was being unfairly accused. Again, as the little prince that he is, nothing is his fault. Everyone wants him. You know, because the ladies just can't get enough of short, saggy-eyed Matt Baker. At first, Linda believed Matt and Carrie's account because she figured if he had actually done those things, he would have been fired, and he wasn't. And Matt never let Carrie out of his sight. Perhaps because he wanted to keep tabs on her, maybe because when people are doing something wrong, they accuse others of the same behavior, or was it because he just didn't want other people telling Carrie who he really was? He even went with her to the salon, the time that she got her hair bleached bright blonde and cut short. This is a typical tactic of emotional or physical abusers. They isolate their partners. And maybe he was ensuring that he was the only source feeding Carrie information. Later, they moved into a 2-bedroom townhome owned by her Aunt Nancy, a complex of 2-story units that backed up to each other with a covered parking area in the back. This is also when Matt began to pursue his career as a minister and had officially decided to enter the seminary. A year had gone by after the allegations against him, and it seemed everyone had forgotten about it. In 1995, he resigned from First Baptist and took a job at the Family Y, where he was running the children's after-school program. I just want to scream back to 1995, get this man away from children. Well, no one can hear my screams from 2020, because unfortunately I'm not a time traveler, but I hope you feel the same. After what seemed like smooth sailing for the first 6 months at the Y, He approached a student worker named Jackie. It was a quiet day at work, and Matt suggested they go to the youth recreation room to work on receipts. It was Jackie's last day before going back to college, and she told him she knew how to fill out the forms. Matt persisted, though, claiming she made errors and he needed to walk her through the process, again, utilizing his sense of power. Remember, with enhanced power, the predator reveals himself. Then this nightmare took place moments later. Matt came up behind the teenager and he put his hands on her breast. She screamed no and pushed him away. But rather than backing off, Matt lunged at the girl, trying to kiss her. Jackie pushed him away again and then he said, "I know you want it," groping between her legs. Then he grabbed her hand, forced it on his pants on top of his penis as she kept screaming no. And then he pushed her against the wall and the little troll, Matt Baker, oozed the words, "I just want to fuck you right here, right now." Just then, the phone rang, saving poor Jackie from her attacker. Matt then, in the calmest of manners, said, "They must be looking for us. We should head back." As if this was some romantic tryst two lovers consensually snuck off for and now shared this little secret they were almost caught. "No, Matt, you're a disgusting creep, and this innocent young teenager does not want any part of your Humpty Dumpty body or narcissistic personality." Jackie left for college and did not report the incident at the time. Meanwhile, poor Carrie was blissfully happy in her marriage and was now pregnant with their first child, tying her further to a very dangerous man. To be fair, Carrie did not know about every incident that was piling up, but she may have knew enough, but was in denial. She had no way of knowing how much this denial, though, would erode her sense of self and eventually her happiness. In April 1996, Kenzie Baker was born. Blue-eyed, blonde hair, adorable little baby. She was colicky in the first few months and wasn't the easiest infant, but Carrie adored her. She dressed her in pretty clothes and styled her hair with bows. Linda said that Matt did take on a share of the parenting roles. She said Matt was the first one who jumped to bathe Kenzie and wash her hair. It would become his thing. It wasn't that Carrie didn't want to, but that Matt insisted he would. But this doting dad was being flooded with allegations of sexual abuse. Three more teenage girls filed complaints with the Y, saying that Matt had came on to them. He asked one girl if she would have sex with a married man. The teenager said no. And although the girl turned him down, later, Matt kept propositioning her. While she was handing out Pop-Tarts to the children in the rec room, he said, "I want your cherry." "Oh, God, Matt, you're gross." When he didn't stop, the girl filed a complaint. But after, he came up to her and said, "You knew I was joking, didn't you?" This may have prompted Jackie, the college student who he had sexually assaulted prior to this, to report what had happened to her. The Y's administrator called Matt in to confront him about these claims. He apparently did not deny the women's claims, and he was immediately fired. The termination letter, effective immediately, said the cause was a lack of performance of job duties in a professional and effective manner, a display of poor attitude towards responsibilities of your position, lack of positive influence and direction of supervised staff, and for inappropriate behavior toward female staff members. But what did he tell Carrie? Oh, well, he said he was simply trying to counsel the girls against becoming sexually active, and they misinterpreted his intentions. I mean, as a Baptist minister, he's got free range to do whatever he sees fit, right? Wrong. And her Aunt Kay would later recall that none of them believed him. But Carrie did. And the firing of Matt Baker from short-lived jobs was starting to become a pattern. He ping-ponged from job to job, likely running from each allegation. But Carrie stood by Matt, believing, or at least convincing herself, that these were just confused teenagers who had misinterpreted Matt's interest.
Want to try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
One bite will destroy your
body. Stop it! Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com, S-I-G-N-O-S.com, with code SPARK, Cygnos.
Amongst all of this, a second little bundle of joy was born, Cassidy Baker, a little round baby with big blue eyes and blonde hair. Cassidy was an easy baby. The details of his firing was never reported to the higher-ups, and Matt became a student at Baylor's Theological Seminary, while Carrie was also at Baylor continuing her education to become a teacher. Around this time, Matt gave Carrie a gift, a green leather Bible. The Quest Study Bible, where Carrie would read and record her thoughts. In this Bible, she would highlight the passage, "Wives, submit to your own husband as to the Lord." She believed her role was to serve Matt, so much so that years later, she would advise a young woman, perhaps this advice came from a place of Carrie convincing herself this was the right way to live, because after all, Carrie wasn't a pushover in any other area of her life. Yet, Carrie told the young woman, who was about to marry a man studying for his ministry, "People will attack your husband. They'll say false things because they have agendas. Sometimes women will tell lies because they'll see a good man and want one for themselves. You have to love your husband and believe in him, even when no one else does. The ministry is a hard life, and you have to back your husband up and be there for him so that he can do God's work." The little prince and his manipulative ways strike again. And like Matt Baker's escalating sexual attacks, Carrie's defense of him would escalate as well. One afternoon, a teenage girl who lived in the house behind Matt and Carrie's told her mother that Matt had asked her if she'd ever kissed a boy. Then he grabbed her and forcefully kissed her on the lips. The girl's mother was a friend of Carrie's Aunt Nancy and told her what had happened. But the girl's mom didn't know whether to believe her daughter. She thought the girl might be exaggerating. Aunt Nancy would later say, "I believe what the girl had said, and it broke my heart. But I had to protect Carrie, and so I acted noncommittal." Nancy did, however, call Carrie's mother, Linda, who then talked to Carrie. Carrie became immediately angry, saying, "Matt didn't do that, Mom." Then, in an act of Carrie's denial-ridden escalation, she hung up the phone with her mom and pounded on the neighbor's door with Matt in tow. Carrie defended him to the mother's face, and Carrie began sobbing and pleading with the mother. How could she say something like that? This pattern continued. Linda would later say that Matt would hang back and let Carrie argue for him. Matt had manipulated Carrie to the point of unquestioned obedience, but Carrie believed him. So much so that she was able to persuade other people to believe in him too. At the very least, Carrie was forcing herself into denial as a form of self-preservation. A quote from playwright Eve Ensler says of denial, "I think the greatest illusion we have is that denial protects us. It's actually the biggest distortion and a lie. In fact, staying asleep is what's killing us." In an article on theoverwhelmedbrain.com, it breaks down what denial can do to a person. Denial can systematically, bit by bit, disintegrate your passion for life. Denial is when you justify beliefs that are poisonous to you. When you choose to believe something that deep down you know not to be true, it eats away at you day by day, and soon you develop new ways to cope at darker levels of being. In fact, you create a whole new homeostatic state where you level off. Homeostasis is when everything is functioning normally. So where you were before you started this process of denial was your previous homeostatic state. So if you were at all unhappy or unfulfilled then you're going to be even more unhappy and unfulfilled after denial kicks in. Then you'll start living life from this new place and thinking, that's as good as things get. Being in this place changes your perspective. You start thinking things like, well, at least it's not any worse. I can live with this because it could be worse. It's kind of a morbid anecdote, but the story goes, if you put a frog in cool water, it's fine. It will be happy. If a frog can be such a thing and will stay there if nothing tempts it to leave. Then, when the water is heated very slowly, the frog won't notice the change in temperature and will continue to sit there. Think of this part as the things that happen in life that you start ignoring or denying so that you can avoid dealing with some hard-to-handle emotions. Then, the water heats up more, coming to a boil, and the frog dies. This is what happens when denial continues. You get to avoid some pain now and face the brunt of it later in a big way. You avoid the pain by denying what you feel and making excuses in an attempt to justify what's happening in your world. If you can create good reasons for bad things, you can survive the boiling water just a little longer. And Carrie had no idea just how hot her waters were going to become. At this point, Matt was doing well in his studies, and Carrie was on track to become a student teacher in about a year. Matt eventually took the pastor's job at Williams Creek Baptist, and Carrie was an eager pastor's wife, helping Matt build the congregation, approaching the people of the town, selling them on giving Matt a chance. Carrie was a bubbly, upbeat mother, so proud of her little girls.
I love you, Mommy.
Friends would describe her as resilient. I love you, it seemed Mommy. Nothing could frazzle her. But no one could have expected the heartbreaking tragedy that would come next. The family gathered to celebrate Cassidy's first birthday, Carrie and Matt's second baby girl. After the celebration, Cassidy threw up, though, and everyone thought, well, maybe she had too much cake. Then, the next Sunday afternoon, Cassidy threw up again, and it continued all night until Carrie and Matt took the little one to her pediatrician, who diagnosed Cassidy with a stomach bug. Telling them to give her lots of fluids, they sent them home, but said to call if things did not improve. Cassidy wasn't getting better, though, and was eventually admitted to the hospital and hooked up to an IV, as the doctors were worried that she was dehydrated. She stayed there through the night. Everyone was so worried, but Carrie encouraged her mom, Linda, to still attend her work conference in New York. And Carrie and Matt also attended church that Sunday morning, while Matt's mom, Barbara, and Carrie's father, Jim, watched over Cassidy. As they spoke, Cassidy threw her head back and her little body stiffened, and they realized she was having a seizure. They called the doctors in, and they were rubbing the little baby's tummy and legs while waiting. The doctors began to run tests, ruling out various low-grade illnesses. As Linda flew back to be with Carrie and Matt and the rest of the family, she arrived in time to hear the terrible news. After the doctors reviewed Cassidy's MRI, they told the family that Cassidy had a tumor at the base of her brain. They needed to surgically remove it, but warned them that the surgery would be risky because of Cassidy's age. However, not doing the surgery was not an option if they wanted to save Cassidy, and the little baby was transferred to Cook Children's Hospital to prepare. The day of the surgery, they were surrounded by generations of Carrie's family, along with Matt's mom and dad and his sister Stacy. When the doctors came out, they said that Cassidy's tumor had been successfully removed, but they were concerned by the effects of the anesthesia. She was so tiny and helpless, hooked up to all those monitors, it was heartbreaking. The doctors said, as a result of the anesthesia, she was increasingly at risk. They said she had a pulmonary edema and her lungs were hardening. In a last-ditch effort to save her, the surgeon cut a tracheotomy and inserted a tube for a respirator and put the child into a medically induced coma. Carrie and Matt seemed strong. Carrie prayed and told friends that they would get through this. Cassidy would get better and they would bring her home. It was a long few months with Cassidy in the ICU, but they were surrounded by family, and Carrie believed she had a good, strong man by her side. She would say to friends, "Matt's just so solid." How devastating to think that and not know what Matt was doing right under her nose. In January, while Cassidy was still in the ICU, Lindsay, Carrie's cousin, came to visit Cassidy. She brought her friend Aaron, who worked with her at the Cracker Barrel. Aaron had never met Matt or Carrie, so Lindsay gave her the rundown on the drive there, describing Matt's questionable behavior towards women. Lindsay said, "Be careful around him. He sometimes does strange things." Aaron responded, "He's a preacher, though?" Lindsay, "Yes. Yes, he is." Aaron was an attractive 20-year-old, and she brushed off what Lindsay had said, thinking, "Surely he won't hit on me in the hospital where his baby girl might be dying. No one would do that." Lindsay wasn't convinced, though. When they arrived at the hospital, because Cassidy was so immune-compromised, only two people wearing sterile gowns and masks could visit Cassidy at a time. So, while Lindsay and Carrie went into Cassidy's room, Aaron sat in a waiting room for them. She began playing a computer game with a young boy, a cancer patient, who was receiving treatment at the hospital. As she was playing the game, Matt appeared and sat down beside her. Aaron said to him that she was so sorry his daughter was so ill, and she hoped she would get better. Matt, as if not a care in the world, not even hearing what Aaron had said or that his baby girl was fighting for her life, just rooms away, said, "You're a beautiful girl." Aaron, trying to focus on the computer game she was playing, awkwardly said, "Thank you." Matt then moved closer and placed his hand on her leg and said, "They gave us a room to stay in while Cassidy's here. It's close. Would you like to see it?" Aaron moved his hand and said, "No, of course not." Matt didn't stop. He then said, "Lindsay and Carrie would be gone at least 15 minutes, and the room was right down the hall." Then he placed his hand further up her thigh. Aaron said, "No," again, more loudly. Then Aaron, thinking he was done because Matt stood up, but he wasn't. He began massaging her shoulders. With that, Lindsay got up and moved quickly toward where she knew Cassidy's room was and was happy to see that Lindsay and Carrie had just walked out and were removing their sterile gowns. Lindsay was sobbing, and Carrie, likely having experienced seeing her daughter in this state days in and days out, was stoic. Then Matt sauntered up and talked calmly to Carrie and Lindsay as if he hadn't just come on to a complete stranger while his daughter was sick. Lindsay's friend, but mostly while his heartbroken wife was at his daughter's side. Aaron began to give Lindsay the eye of, "We need to go." So they did, and once they were in the elevator, Aaron began to cry. Lindsay asked, "He hit on you, didn't he?" Aaron nodded, and Lindsay said, "I knew it." Aaron asked if they should tell Carrie. Lindsay wasn't sure and said she would call her mom Nancy to get her advice. Lindsay did, and even Nancy was unsure what to do. So they called the family matriarch, her and Linda's mother and Carrie's grandmother, who decided that Carrie was dealing with enough. This wasn't the time to tell her. And like a rainbow after a storm, Cassidy began making a recovery, a full recovery. She was able to go home, and the doctors instructed the parents on how to care for her, with the tubes needing to remain in for a few months while Cassidy recovered. She was doing amazing. She was learning to walk and pulling herself up on furniture, and she was smiling. She was still getting chemo, but she was thriving. Matt and Carrie even hired a home healthcare nurse to watch over Cassidy so they could return to classes. At night, Cassidy wore a monitor, not uncommon for babies at risk for sudden infant death syndrome. It would alert the parents if the infant stopped breathing. Then one night, they put the kids to bed. And then, at about 12 a.m., for no apparent reason, Matt got up to check on both girls. He said they were doing fine. But then, oddly, he rose again, just 9 minutes later, and checked on Cassidy for a third time. He would later say, "I don't know, something wouldn't let me sleep. I knew I had to check on her again." He would recount the event, saying the monitor wasn't attached, no alarm had sounded, and Cassidy wasn't breathing. He said he yelled for Carrie to call 911 as he took Cassidy out of bed and started CPR. Carrie would later say, describing that night, that she heard Matt scream and she rushed and called 911, begging them to hurry while Matt allegedly continued to do CPR. But Carrie would never know what actually happened in that nursery, because Matt ordered Carrie not to enter the nursery and to wait for the ambulance. The guilt of following Matt's demands and not being there would haunt Carrie. Linda would later recall that on the same night, Aunt Nancy's new grandson, Jojo, was born at only 28 weeks and only 2 pounds, and he was not expected to survive. Yet he was improving. In the same hospital, as Nancy rushed back down the stairs to check back in on Carrie and Cassidy, she couldn't help but think that the doctors had said Cassidy was cured and that she was okay to be at home. It seemed so strange that Jojo was going to be all right and Carrie was losing her baby. Linda would say, "I think my baby is losing her baby." Then Cassidy's doctor turned to all of them and said, "There's nothing else we can do." Everyone erupted into uncontrollable sobs, and minutes later, Nancy happened to look over at Matt and made a note in her brain that it seemed like Matt was just watching a mildly interesting TV show. He showed no emotion. And then, in a bizarre move, after standing off to the side, unemotional, Matt lurched towards Cassidy and grabbed her tracheotomy tube. Carrie yelled, "What are you doing? Leave her alone!" Matt continued until Carrie shielded her daughter and held her dead daughter's body away from Matt Baker. The days following were filled with anguish and pain and grief. The church and the community rallied around them. At the funeral, Carrie brought one of her friends, Janelle, whom weeks earlier Carrie had told how wonderful Cassidy was doing, to view Cassidy's lifeless body. And her friend Janelle couldn't help but notice the dark bruises on Cassidy's mouth and nose. Carrie immediately said, "I think those are from the CPR." The funeral was painful for Carrie. She threw her body over Cassidy's casket at one point. But while others watched Carrie mourn and grieve, it seemed that Matt enjoyed the attention, almost acting like this was his debutante ball. Janelle, Carrie's friend, wouldn't be the only person concerned by Cassidy's fate. For days after Cassidy's funeral, Carrie was with her mother, plagued by sorrow, but knowing she had to inform others that Cassidy had died. So, Carrie called and left a message for Cassidy's oncologist, the one who had worked so hard to fight for Cassidy and had sent her home with a healthy prognosis and a beautiful future. When the doctor called back, Linda stood by listening and heard the conversation. Carrie cried, giving the doctor the news, but instead of commiserating with Carrie, the doctor blurted out, "Cassidy wasn't supposed to die. How could she be dead?" Carrie and Linda were both stunned. The doctor said, "There's something wrong. I'm calling Child Protective Services." Linda, feeling her daughter's grief and just as confused as she was, said, "Well, that's just crazy." Eventually, an appointment was made and CPS came over to the Baker household. Matt was there too. The CPS worker surveyed the house, noting anything she may have felt amiss, then spoke to the couple. Once Matt assured her that they had had a home health nurse, the CPS worker must have felt at ease and closed the case and left the two, well, mostly Carrie, to mourn. Carrie would recall that Cassidy's sickness almost seemed like an inconvenience to Matt. She couldn't understand why she was so broken, and he almost seemed relieved, going on with his life, returning to the pulpit just days later. Carrie struggled with the heartbreak of losing her baby, but encouraged by her mom, not one to let things fester, Carrie sought counseling with Dr. Joanne Bristol, a counselor and family friend. Carrie would begin to heal and would sometimes admire Matt's strength or lack of emotion, albeit confused, wishing she could be as strong. But Carrie was strong. She kept working and caring for her little Kenzie. Occasionally, she would spend a whole day in bed, watching home videos of Cassidy, a seemingly normal and healthy response to the loss of a baby. Then, just over a year after Cassidy's death, Carrie became pregnant with another baby girl, Grace, a miracle baby. When the doctors announced that Grace was born healthy, Carrie sobbed out of joy and relief. Both Kenzie and Grace were Carrie's pride and joy, and while she still missed her little Cassidy, she pressed on and worked on herself and visited Dr. Bristol regularly, working through her grief. They worked long and hard on Carrie's healing, and after a year or so, Carrie told Bristol that she felt better. She felt lighter and didn't think she needed to continue consistent therapy. Things seemed to be as best they could despite the tragedy. Matt was working hard as a minister. Carrie was a doting mother and an excited teacher. And then one day, a small hiccup should have sent more warning flares into Carrie's trust of Matt, but it seemed nothing would. Carrie called Linda and said, "Mom, someone stole our debit card and charged phone sex and porn on the internet. The account was overdrawn." When she told Matt, he claimed that someone had stolen his debit card and that the thief must have used it on the internet. Carrie, as always, believed him and marched right down to the bank and explained to the bank worker that she hadn't purchased porn and that her husband, a Baptist minister, certainly hadn't. The bank employee, seemingly convinced, reversed all charges and Carrie was settled. But as Carrie might learn later, there's always another fire to put out with Matt Baker. And this time, she didn't know where the embers were coming from. Carrie began to feel like Matt was pushing her away. But like everything else, he always had an excuse, this time saying that he spent the beginning of their marriage chasing her, and he was tired of feeling less than. Carrie, always willing to accept blame, decided that she needed to work harder on their marriage and started offering fun sexual advances and trying to spice things up and encouraging them to spend quality time together. They often communicated via email while they were both at work. And while Carrie was trying to offer up herself and suggest they work on loving each other more and reigniting things, Matt would respond that he loved her, but because of his years of chasing, now that Carrie was ready, he needed some time to catch up. Or perhaps his time was taken by someone else. A young, striking blonde named Vanessa Bowles began attending his church. She was 23 and stopped Matt in his tracks. Vanessa had a young baby and was going through a divorce. Vanessa's father was the church's music minister. Vanessa was also living with her parents at the time while she settled her divorce. At a church potluck, Vanessa was on the phone with a friend and said that she needed to hang up because a new guy was calling her. Vanessa says that this is when Matt motioned her into the hallway to follow him. And once they got away from the group, Matt said, "Will you really? Will I really what? Will you really date your pastor?" Matt continued, "Well, I've had a vasectomy, so you can't get pregnant, and I don't have any STDs. Vanessa, "Have you done that before?" Matt nodded yes and then said, "Carrie's clueless." Soon after, Matt would find secret ways to talk to Vanessa before or after church, one time saying, "Any man who gets you is lucky."
Vanessa Bull said she was going through a divorce when she first met the then preacher Matt Baker at church.
"He looked at my daughter and I and said, 'Whoever finds you is going to be a lucky man.'"
Another time, telling her that he had counseled people going through divorces and he himself had lost a child and had assured her that the Lord could get her through anything. Eventually, he moved the counseling sessions to he and Carrie's home, specifically on Fridays when Carrie and the girls would be at school and Matt had the day off. It was then that this happened.
"He could hold my hands to pray, and he did. Then afterwards, he started to kiss me. Then he just took my hand and led me to the bedroom."
Meanwhile, Carrie continually felt Matt pulling away as if she was doing something wrong. She kept trying. She kept hoping. Then one day, uncharacteristic of Carrie to discuss Matt in a negative light, she called a friend sobbing and said, "I think Matt is having an affair." The friend offered to come be with her, but Carrie said, "Wait," and hung up and then called her back and said she was fine. Carrie did this a lot when it came to Matt. She downplayed her feminine intuition and her gut instincts in order to smooth things over with Matt. Carrie eventually decided to go back and see her therapist, Joanne Bristol. She was having a hard time, not because of losing Cassidy, though that always stayed with her. And she was even excited about her new job prospects and had told people, including Dr. Bristol, that she had felt she had a calling to help other grieving parents who had lost a child. All the while, Matt was planting the seed to anyone that would listen that something was wrong with Carrie. She was depressed. She was anxious. She was not living up to her wifely and motherly duties. But he mostly laid these lies on thick to the object of his affection, Vanessa Bowles, his mistress. The mistress who began to sit in the front row at church, two rows closer than even Carrie and the girls, and would sit through Matt's sermon smiling up at her lackluster man. The morning before Carrie met with Dr. Bristol, she went in for a job interview and was elated by the results. She called her mom and said, "I nailed it." She also told Dr. Bristol how excited that she was. But then she began to confide in Bristol that something had happened. She said, "I found crushed up pills in Matt's briefcase. I think he's having an affair, and I think he might be trying to kill me." Bristol asked her to repeat that, so she did. But then, as always, Carrie quickly brushed off her statement, calling herself crazy and saying, "Oh my God, Matt would never." But she had no way of knowing how close to the truth her instincts were. Carrie wrote in her Bible, "Lord, I'm asking you to protect me from harm. I am not sure what is going on with Matt, but Lord, help me find peace with him." A prayer Carrie needed answered in order to save her life. next week, you will hear about Matt's shocking crime and the disgusting ways he attempted to cover it up. Matt Baker, however, would be no match for the She-Ras, the Charlie's Angels, that are Carrie's parents, aunts, and cousins that rallied around Carrie, showing that a family's love could conquer all. This story is a striking example of the power of love and determination and a victory of truth over Matt Baker's carefully constructed life of hypocrisy. Thank you so much for listening, and the best way you can show that you enjoy the show is to tell a friend. Leave a 5-star rating and positive review. It really means the world to have your support. Seven Deadly Sinners was written and created by me, Rachel O'Brien. Sound engineering and music production by Greg Hunter. And produced by Rachel O'Brien and Greg Hunter. Thank you for listening.